I am Planta on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Mr. Justice Harvey Brownstone currently presides at the North Toronto Family Court. He has written a very useful resource, one that's highly readable even if you're not dealing with child custody issues and the sort. The book is called Tug of War, A Judge's Verdict on Separation, Custody Battles, and the Bitter Realities of Family Court. It wades through a lot of jargon and legalese, making for interesting reading. It's also necessary if you're in the midst of the separation process. In fact, it's been widely recommended for parents and warring spouses. Justice Brownstone is a respected judge, and before becoming a provincial judge in 1995, he was the director of the Support and Custody Enforcement Program of the Ontario Ministry of the Attorney General. He received his LLB from Queen's University. The book is published by ECW Press, and it's already a bestseller. All of the author's royalties are being donated to the Children's Wish Foundation. Please welcome to the Plant Online program, in his chambers, as a matter of fact, the Honorable Mr. Justice Harvey Brownstone. Good morning, Your Honor.
Good morning, Joseph. Thank you for having me on your show.
You're very welcome. This book, what compelled you to write it?
Well, I've been a judge for 14 years, and it's troubled me deeply for a long time that the only opportunity people ever get to hear from a judge is when they're in front of us, all geared up for the battle of their lives. And it, by that time, in my view, it's already too late. They've lost a really golden opportunity to look at the alternatives to family court before they launch themselves into these potentially catastrophic, high-conflict, protracted custody and access disputes. And I thought that it was time for a judge to speak out and give people some advance information so that they can make the best informed decisions about whether they want to use the justice system. And if they are going to, then they should have a good idea of what to expect.
Were you worried about what your superiors would say about a judge writing a book?
I had a lot of concerns about not only the idea of a judge writing a book that speaks directly to the public, but also doing a very intensive media promotional campaign, which, as you probably understand, publishers require the authors to do that, because that's the only way that a book will ever be known. And so this is forging new territory. There's no question about it. Judges don't generally go on TV and on the radio and give interviews, and they certainly don't write books that are on the mass market. But I think the time has changed, and that judges should be not just adjudicators, but also public educators, because we do have a lot of insights and information to share with the public. But as I say, the problem is the people who most need to hear it don't hear it until it's too late.
You talked about the costs of going to court and going through these processes is quite high. Is that because of lawyers?
No, it's because the system is an adversarial system that has a win-lose mentality. But unfortunately, when it comes to parents litigating over their children, there is no winning in family court. There's only degrees of losing. And the biggest losers are the children. And I think the reason for that is because judges are not social workers or child psychologists. We are lawyers. The justice system is all about the law. But when two people are having difficulty communicating with each other and making decisions together about their children, that's not really a legal problem. That's a problem that they're having in their own interpersonal relationship. They need to find a way to reinvent themselves from ex-partners to co-parents. And that's not going to happen in a courtroom.
For some context, Judge Brownstone, I'm in these experiences that you're talking about in the book and that we'll read about in the book, the statistics on divorce and the sort, these are universal in the sense that we see these throughout Canada, it doesn't matter what province you're from, as well as the United States, right?
I think that family breakdown is an epidemic. I really think that it's a public health issue. The divorce rate in Canada is 38%. In the United States, it's 45%. And that's just the couples that get married. We don't even know what the breakup rate is for common law couples who have just lived together and had children. But everyone assumes that it's much, much higher than the divorce rate. And so really it is an epidemic. I don't think there's anybody out there who isn't touched by or knows somebody who is touched by family breakdown.
This might be a silly question, but if one were in a common law relationship and it did end and children were involved, do they still go to court?
If they cannot resolve their parenting questions, If they can't come up with a parenting plan, yes, they would have to come to court. It doesn't matter whether you're married or whether you're common law or whether you even just had a casual relationship that where you never cohabited. The thing is, there's a mother and there's a father, or in same-sex relationships, there may be two mothers or two fathers, but if the parents can't agree on where that child's going to live and how often that child's going to be with each parent, then the only way to get that decision made is the court, unless they look at some of the alternatives that I mentioned in the book, like mediation, collaborative law, parenting coaching, which I think are much, much more suitable for parents because it teaches parents how to carve out a new relationship for themselves where they can be a little bit more cooperative rather than adversarial as we are in the court system.
Now, if we look at the breakups of families, in terms of, let's say if we had to profile the sort of people that go through the system, is it one side of the socioeconomic scale over another? Do we see all sorts of cultures? Considering the statistics on marriage, do you also see same-sex unions coming in and to your courts as well?
Marriage breakdown spans every socioeconomic category, every culture, every race, every sexual orientation. It is it's recession-proof, it is class-proof, it's colorblind, it affects everybody.
I feel like a senator asking this question. In terms of your judicial philosophy, do you weigh into consideration the outcome of your decision, like the impact of your decision, or do you go by the law as it is, or are you simply guided by precedents?
Well, the law regarding custody and access is that the court must decide what is in the best interest of the child. And that's kind of a nebulous term that encompasses all of the circumstances of the parents and the child and the family. And so what judges try to do is look at the parenting that has gone on so far and see if we can make the marriage breakdown as seamless as possible for the child, because we don't want to disrupt children any more than they already are when their parents break up. We try to minimize conflict. We try to keep siblings together. We try to maximize the time that each parent will have with the children. But we definitely look at the consequences of our decisions. But the problem really for judges, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book, is that we are dependent on the parents to give us the best possible evidence about what is in the best interest of the children. You know, how are they doing at school? How is their health? What activities are they involved in? Do they have any special needs? But instead, because of the emotional aspects of marriage breakdown and the amount of pain that people are feeling and anger, we are often dealing with parents giving us all kinds of evidence about each other, slinging all the mud they can think of to show us how each parent failed to meet the other's needs, when what we should be looking at is how they're going to meet the children's needs. And so it's very, very difficult for a stranger who doesn't know these people and doesn't know their children to make decisions, important decisions, about children's lives. And I really think that parents who expect a stranger to be able to do that are really running a risk that they may not be very happy with the decision that the judge reaches.
Now, before a case appears before you in your courtroom, do you speak to the parents? Do you speak to the children beforehand?
No, we don't speak to anybody outside of the courtroom. And as far as the children goes, it is generally considered inappropriate for the children to become involved in the dispute. We try to shield and insulate them from parental conflicts. And so we don't generally, as a rule, meet with children. Although, if they're old enough and if their views and preferences should be before the court, there are ways of doing that doesn't put them in the middle. We can appoint a lawyer for the child. We can have an assessment done by a social worker or a child psychologist that would tell us what the children are feeling, what their preferences are. But we generally try not to put them in the middle of parental tugs of war.
There's a title of the book. In terms of some of these myths that we have, that access and child support, that if one doesn't get access, they're not responsible for supporting the child financially. That's a myth, isn't it?
Yes, there's a lot of myths out there. There are people that think that if you live together for 3 years, it's just the same as being married. There are lots of custodial parents that think that if child support isn't being paid, they don't have to allow access to the child. And there are lots of support payers out there that think that if they're not being allowed to see the child, they don't have to pay support. There are men out there that think that if they've been tricked into having unprotected sex with the woman that leads to a pregnancy, that they don't have to pay support. There are all kinds of myths out there that I've tried to debunk in my book because they really do a lot of damage to people, and people are in for a big shock when they come to court and find out that the law is not what they thought it was.
And if one parent is abusive, does that automatically disqualify them from having access to a child?
Abusive to who?
To the child.
I think that if a parent has been found to be abusive or neglectful to a child, they can expect to have their access to the child supervised if they're going to have any access at all. But the harder question is what to do with parents that have been abusive to each other, sometimes in the presence of a child. There are many people who feel that a child should not ever have to see a parent who has been abusive to the other parent. But children have a right to have a relationship with both parents, and sometimes the way we behave towards our partners or our ex-partners may not necessarily dictate how we're going to, what kind of parenting skills we have. And so any parent that tries to cut a child off from the other parent can expect an uphill battle, but it has been done. If a court finds that it's not in the best interest of a child to have any contact with that parent, but they will still have to pay child support.
And can a court compel a child to include a parent in their life and vice versa? Can a parent be forced to be a part of a child's life?
Well, a court could order police enforcement of an access order if one parent is denying access to the child to the other parent. Courts can order the police to go in there and enforce the access. Sometimes the police will do it and sometimes they will not. It depends on the age of the child and how adamant the child is that he or she doesn't want to see the other parent. Sometimes parents bring contempt motions where they're looking for the court to send the other parent to jail for violating the court order. But generally speaking, the courts do expect parents to follow the court order and to make their children do what they're supposed to do. You know, if a child said that he didn't want to go to school, I don't think it would be acceptable for a parent to say, well, you don't have to go. And yet somehow parents think that it's okay when a young child says, I don't want to see the other parent. And that's not okay. Children don't get to make those decisions until they're much older, usually by about 16.
Did you deal in the book with men and husbands sort of getting a bad rap? We seem to see that in the press a lot, deadbeat dads and the sort.
I think that there is a widespread belief out there that family courts are harder on fathers than they are on mothers, that we don't treat fathers and mothers equally, that we are much more lenient towards mothers. I think that is the perception out there. I've been doing a lot of media for the book in the last 4 months, and I would be—I would have to be out of my mind if I didn't acknowledge. But the thing to remember is that courts are really not interested in the rights of parents when it comes to custody and access. Parents really don't have rights. Parents have obligations. Children have the rights. And I think that it's easy to feel like a victim when you've broken up with someone and to go into court feeling that you're the hard done by one. You are the victim. The fact is it's the children that are the victims of these things, and courts look at what parenting has occurred in the past in order to predict what kind of, to measure parenting skills, first of all, and to predict a good parenting plan for the child. And in many, many cases, not all, but certainly in many, many cases, mothers have been the primary caregivers of children, and that is why they generally end up having primary responsibility. It's not because courts think that fathers are less qualified. In fact, the law is that there are no presumptions in favor of mothers or fathers, that both parents are considered equally capable. But the reality, at least as I see it, and many of my colleagues across the world, when you look at who has actually been primarily responsible for meeting the children's needs during the relationship, it was the mother. And so it shouldn't surprise people that courts are going to try to sustain a parenting arrangement that seems to have worked. But there are lots and lots of cases where parents reach shared parenting arrangements, where courts do impose joint custody with parallel parenting or shared parenting, but the court has to see that there are good parenting skills there for both sides and that there's a willingness to cooperate with each other and communicate with each other so that the child has some consistency and some peace in his or her life.
You talk in the book about the folly of representing oneself in court. Why is it that people do that? Is it finances?
I think the number one reason that people represent themselves is because they've watched television, and in particular, Judge Judy. And they think that since nobody has a lawyer on that show, they should just be able to get up and tell the judge their story and that the judge is going to make a decision and then there's going to be a commercial. And it doesn't occur to them that we're talking here about a TV show, and by the way, she's not doing family court, she's doing small claims court. I really do think that the majority of people that I see, and I'll tell you that around the country in the major centers, we're looking at up to 70% of litigants with no lawyers at all, representing themselves, having watched television, thinking that they don't need lawyers because they can do it themselves. There is another group of people who really want to have a lawyer but can't afford one, and that's a very serious issue. And I think it's really tragic when someone who wants legal representation genuinely cannot afford them. And to that person, I would say, if you can't get a lawyer to take your whole case, at least try to get a consultation for an hour or two with a lawyer just to make sure that your paperwork is correct and that you've got the evidence you need and that you know what your rights and your obligations are. But to the larger group of people out there who really don't understand why you need a lawyer, I would really urge them to read my book. There's a chapter in there that explains what lawyers do, why you need one, how to pick one, and how to know whether your lawyer is doing a good job.
You talked about the whole system being an adversarial one. What about family courts are you critical of, as someone who's in the, you know, as a judge in one?
Well, I think that if we were to create a brand new justice system today and start from scratch for family law, I think everyone agrees it would not look like the system we've got. That the justice system that works for other kinds of cases, like wrongful dismissal or medical malpractice or breach of contract, those rules work fine for people that are never going to have to see each other again, where you sue somebody and then there's maybe damages to pay and then you never deal with them again. But the thing that makes family court so unique is that these parents are going to have to deal with each other for the next 20 years. They're going to have to go to school events together. They're going to have to walk their children down the aisle. Heck, they're even going to have to dance with each other at their children's weddings. And the court system does not set people up to do that because it has such an adversarial system. And I think that mediation is far more effective at helping parents make peace rather than war. And so I think that by writing the book and trying to highlight how very, very damaging litigation is for parents and children and how bad family court really is for families, I'm making a plea to parents to try to get the counseling they need to put their anger towards each other behind them so that they can start dealing with each other for the next 20 years, because that's what they're going to have to do, for the sake of their children. And, you know, I often tell parents, it's much more important to have peace than to be right. And parents that come to court hoping that they're going to take the other parent to the cleaners or to run the other parent into the ground are really not arguing over the children at all. These are battles for power and control. They're based on the need for vengeance. And the courts are not in the vengeance business.
And you call for maturity.
Yes, I think it takes a certain degree of maturity for parents to accept that while they may not like each other, while they may be very angry with each other as partners, they have chosen each other to have children with, and you can be an ex-husband or an ex-wife, but you're never going to be an ex-mother or an ex-father. And so you have to find a way to work together in a civilized, mature way with your ex-partner for the sake of giving your children a peaceful childhood, because they're not at fault when parents break up. It is not their fault, and they should not be made to pay the price. But too many children are paying the price in terms of severe emotional harm because they are put in the middle of very, very high conflict and toxic parental tugs of war.
You must be gratified by the book being a bestseller as it has been.
Yes, as we speak, the book has completed its eighth week on the national bestseller list. The book is in third printing after only being out 4 months. I never expected the book would reach such, that the media and the public would latch onto it with such enthusiasm, and I think it does validate the fact that people really do care what judges have to say, and that family law issues are very, very important to a high number of people in this country, and throughout North America, because the book's doing very well in the United States as well.
Justice Brownstone, you've done a great service. Congratulations and continued good luck with the book. You've been very good to speak with us today.
Thank you, Joseph. Thank you for highlighting this very important issue for your listeners.
You're very welcome. The book is called Tug of War, A Judge's Verdict on Separation, Custody Battles, and the Bitter Realities of Family Court. ECW Press is its publisher, Mr. Justice Harvey Brownstone, on the line. I'm Joseph Planta.